Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is Tuesday, March 29, and we have a very special program that is going out live on YouTube and will also be recorded and published as well. Today we have Zoltan Pozsar and Ira Harris. Zoltan is Credit Suisse Global Head of Short-Term Interest Rates and a former U.S. Federal Reserve and U.S. Treasury Department official. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. And really, thanks for Zoltan for being here, because this is a truly great pleasure and honor. So you're on.
The pleasure is mine. It's very nice to be here.
Yeah.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion on your recent writings, Zoltan, in terms of the paper you put out called Bretton Woods 3, if you'd like to give a short summary of that and what you had in mind.
Yes, the short summary about Bretton Woods 3 is that I think we are basically 30 days or whenever the war started, 30 days into a completely new monetary regime, a new inflation regime, and a new regime for interest rates. Again, you don't see most of this kind of regime change in real time, obviously, but I think changes have been triggered, and you know, 5 years, 10 years from now, when we will look back, I think we will look at the past couple of weeks as a period of time where a number of things have happened. Number one, I think the status of not only the U.S. dollar, G7 inside money being forms of money claims that are the liabilities of a central bank, or the liabilities of a private bank, or the liability of a government. That types of inside money, I think the allure of such instruments has diminished and was tarnished for certain countries. I mean, you know, the world is kind of evolving into this us versus them block. Here I specifically talk about the precedent of freezing half $1 trillion worth of FX reserves that belongs to a major commodity exporter in the world. Just to get the details right here, I like to emphasize to clients when I speak to them that Russia didn't have any treasury securities, neither did they have any onshore U.S. dollar exposure. They sold all their treasury securities in 2018. They don't have any branches in the United States. Russian banks don't have any branches in the United States. They don't really bank with U.S. financial institutions. All their dollars, but they have dollars, but the dollars they have are all euro dollars. And as both of you know very well, you know, euro dollars are stateless money. It's no one's liability. It's just, you know, ledger entries on bank balance sheets offshore. And a lot of these dollars that Russia had were lent in the FX swap market. And, you know, an FX swap is just a spot sale and forward commitment to repurchase dollars. But when you sell dollars and you get euros and yen in exchange for them, you basically, as a central bank, get to deposit those balances at other central banks like the Bundesbank and like the Bank of Japan. And basically what the freezing of FX reserves meant in the case of Russia is that a lot of balances at the Bundesbank were frozen and a lot of balances at the Bank of Japan were frozen. If you scroll through the Bloomberg headlines in the days when all these freezings of the assets have happened, you know, you saw that, you know, the Bank of Japan and Japan went along with the G7 to freeze the assets of the Russian central bank. So, you know, the bigger point here is that you know, this was a U.S. coordinated effort for the G7 countries and G7 central banks to freeze the assets of another central bank from a quote unquote unfriendly jurisdiction. So this is big. This is not about the dollar. I think this is just as much about the euro as a reserve asset. And again, you know, Australia is on friendly terms with Europe, obviously. But you know, if you think out loud, you probably can pick a number of countries that have, you know, potential geopolitical flashpoints with the U.S. You know, diplomatic or military in the not so distant future. And it's certainly going to make these other central banks and other countries think about what constitutes a good form of FX reserve. So again, number one pillar of Bretton Woods 3 is that the world as we know it, where everybody is happy to export to the US, get paid in dollars, and recycle those dollars onshore or offshore in the euro dollar market, I think that whole mechanism has been damaged. It's inevitable that change will come out of that. You know, it's not immediate, but it's inevitable. So that's one aspect of Bretton Woods 3. The other comes from, you know, this observation that I just mentioned. If G7 inside money is not what it used to be, and you have to diversify, what else do you do? I mean, you can buy gold, because gold is a monetary asset. And, you know, in the case of Russia, for example, it's good for them to have a lot of physical gold in the basement of the central bank because it provides a useful nominal anchor to the currency in situations like this. Also, if it's not just you know, switching from paper money to the physical money, you can also think about Bretton Woods 3 in terms of alternatives to getting paid in it for commodities exported. You know, so you can invoice commodity exports in ruble. We've seen that example last week. You can invoice trade between China and Saudi Arabia in terms of oil in renminbi, for example. So, you know, it's not only thinking about what else other than G7 inside money to buy gold, but also what other currencies you can invoice things and what other currencies can you start to accumulate surpluses in. And again, you know, the Bretton Woods 3 idea is that this is a breaking point. You know, Bretton Woods 1, everybody knows it. It was the gold link to the dollar. Bretton Woods 2 was the idea. You know, this is David Folkerts Landau and Mr. Dooley, just, you know, highlighting this symbiotic relationship between China and the US. To China exports, accumulates dollars and invests everything in treasuries. And Bretton Woods 3 is probably going to be a hybrid of the two, because we are back to physical anchors to currencies, you know, gold and perhaps other commodities, but also not just the dollar, but other currencies. And those are going to be currencies of the East, not currencies of the West.
Well, very interesting and insightful. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, no, where Zoltan goes with this, and it was when he wrote this, I believe it was 3 weeks ago, he did three major pieces. So it was 3 weeks in a row, and two of them were on the Ukraine. So the Bretton Woods argument was very interesting. And then, of course, we saw what the Russians did last week with saying, well, they'll demand payment in rubles. And it's interesting, as I'm looking at my screen right now, when the Ukrainian invasion occurred on February 24th is our date, the ruble was 81 to 85 to the dollar. Today we're down to 87 to the dollar after being up to about, I don't know, 130, 140, whatever, whatever we want to see on the screen. So that was a smart move, because you say, well, we're not going to, I know that some of the Western countries said, well, we're not going to pay in rubles. Well, of course you are. Yes. It's going to be a matter of how you access those rubles. And I thought that was actually kind of brilliant, because of the Russian central bank under, as I call her, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, but I think she's such a fine central banker, that for all the money printing that they may have had to done, had to do, they will have others absorb some of that in an effort to pay for the oil, because those who are wishing for Russian oil to go away, it's just not possible. And when the media runs with those headlines, it's absolutely ludicrous. As my friend Mike Lies, who is a great Kansas Wildcatter, told me yesterday, you don't just turn on a spigot. You know, it's not like going to your faucet and going, oh, let me have, I need another 2.5 million barrels of oil. It doesn't happen that way. First of all, because the oil sector has been so widely underinvested. And I know Zoltan talked about that. But the impact from the way that I look at things, and I know that people who are listening to this will look at things, the global macro impact. And I think that Zoltan's points are very good. And it won't be, everybody's looking for it to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen tomorrow. There's going to have to be a structural shift, just like, Bretton Woods is about a structural shift.
Yeah.
So if it takes place, and we saw the Saudis, people have to talk to each other in an administration. You can't be sitting there bashing the Saudis and then come hat in hand begging them to fulfill a need that you have. It's just not that easy. And when the Saudis are talking about paying or having the Chinese pay for their oil in yuan, the world really gets interested. And everybody will, the stalwarts of Wall Street who reside in a Bretton Woods mindset, because the Bretton Woods mindset ensures that Giscard d'Estaing called the exorbitant privilege of the United States. But of course, when we did with Michael Pettis a couple months ago, we talked about his view, it's exorbitant, certainly not a privilege, but an exorbitant burden. So things do change, but it will, I'd like to hear Zoltan's opinion on that as we shift away from the dollar's role as reserve currency, I know, tell me about the legal standards and tell me, but things do shift. What will be the impact on U.S. interest rates?
Yes, the impact will not be good is what my instinct would say. Before we get to interest rates, let me just follow up on some of the fine thoughts you had there. The U.S. dollar was the, our currency, your problem type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think with Russian commodities and, pricing it in ruble, it's kind of like our commodities, your problem, how you pay for it. But this is how I'm going to price it. So again, just the fact that we had this kind of 1973 type arrangement where everything we import and move around in terms of commodities is priced in dollars, that very practice is changing before our eyes. And just to be clear, any commodity exporter, and in this case Russia, you can demand payment in rubles. As you mentioned, I think the big question is who is going to be the marginal provider of rubles when basically transactions start to happen in rubles. If it is the central bank can set the price wherever it wants to. And it can set the price at a level that's much stronger than the ruble-euro exchange rate was before the conflict. And you think like that as a central banker in war times, because you want to lower your interest rates and all that stuff to lessen the blow for the domestic economy. So there's that. There is also your ability to charge for things in renminbi, like the Saudis have done or floated that idea, because you can then start to accumulate balances in a friendly jurisdiction that didn't sanction you, and so you can start accumulating RMB balances in the Chinese banking system. And third, you can also, if you want to go wild, you can expect, demand payments for gas delivered in gold too. If all these inside forms of money are just not good, why don't you load a military cargo plane with gold bullion this week for delivery of gas tomorrow? And so I think these are all ideas to consider as potential options here. In terms of what this means for interest rates in the US, I think the implications are huge. What basically people tend to forget is that, you know, when commodity trades are financed in dollars, those are just euro dollars getting created. I mean, just to give you an example, JP Morgan makes a loan to Glencore. You know, you make a loan, create a deposit. Glencore uses those deposits to pay the Saudis, and then the Saudi monetary authority ends up with those dollars, and then they show up at the next treasury auction. So on the margin, when commodity trade is being financed in dollars, dollars get created. And when those dollars get created, they will ultimately get recycled into treasury securities. When you break that loop, you basically have a demand problem. And again, this is not going to be immediate, but over time, you will feel the impact. And you know, this is basically a flow observation, where you're just not going to have the creation of as many dollars on the margin. And then there's also a stock aspect to all this, which is, you know, when you look at the current existing FX reserves of some large reserve managers, do they diversify away from their existing holdings? So there's the stock problem, there's the flow problem. And the combination of these for US interest rates is not good. Now, you know, we live in a world of double entry bookkeeping, and there is always a demand for treasury securities. It's just a question of my problem is that there is drilling going on in the house because they are installing a window in our living room. Can we edit out the background noise?
Yes, we'll do our best. Yes, no problem.
Okay, sounds good. So let me just get back to the train of thought. I wanted to say that because you guys are probably wondering, but so there's this stock problem, and then there's the flow problem, and there's always going to be a different kind of demand for treasuries. But you know, if the demand for treasuries is going to come instead from the U.S. central bank, and it's going to have to do QE just to kind of find the marginal bid for the treasury market, that's obviously going to have an impact on the U.S. dollar. And you know, if the central bank doesn't want to do it directly, then obviously all this is going to show up in the bond basis and much tighter swap spreads, and then the relative value hedge fund community is going to come in. And so you have either a central bank funded demand for treasuries directly, or you have central bank funded demand for treasuries indirectly through RV hedge funds, instead of, you know, large FX reserve managers, namely exporters of commodities and goods, doing the same type of recycling trades that they have been doing for the past 2-3 decades. There is going to be a price impact, without a doubt.
And speaking of interest rates, what do you make on the repo market, the repurchase agreement market, overnight lending? You see rates, FRA, OIS rates, as being indicative of a potential crisis?
Well, look, this is a crisis. But, you know, the conversation we are having about the dollar and demand for treasuries and the creation of euro dollars on the margin, I think that is a quote unquote crisis of the international dollar. And repo is mostly, you know, a story about the domestic dollar. I think, you know, the domestic parts of the money market are going to be fine. For OIS, I think that's probably going to show up, you know, in terms of some structural widening in for OIS, simply because it's an interesting question. If marginal dollars don't get created as much, and basically the world turns away from the dollar as the currency that you invoice and finance everything in, it's actually, I don't know whether that would mean a structural widening or tightening of the basis, but But I guess my instinct would say is that the dollar premium should structurally kind of fade away, because less and less stuff is being financed in dollars, and more and more trade is happening in other currencies. So that's probably something else to think about in the medium term. I mean, certainly we are going to be talking about, you know, if foreign central banks don't buy treasuries and the Fed will have to buy more treasuries, that's certainly going to be a creation of more reserves. But those reserves that we are creating is basically substituting for the fact that there is not as much demand for dollars in the world. Thinking out loud, it might well be the beginning of a regime where the cross-currency basis becomes positive for the U.S. dollar instead of being negative.
And your thoughts, Ira?
That's interesting. So let's draw upon all your experience at the Federal Reserve. Okay. So we had talked about the reverse repo, and I know, God, there's nobody I don't think who knows more about the plumbing of that and has been right about it for so long. But now we have from the July meeting, which irritated me, because when the Fed announced the standing repo facility and the massive size of it and how available it was to foreign entities, I think up to $60 billion, and not just other central banks, but foreign entities. And the fact that the announcement came out 5 or 6 hours in an FT article prior to the FOMC statement that day, and then of course Powell's press conference. So we have this standing repo facility, which is the ability to, of course, pump massive amounts of liquidity on a global basis into the system. And I was upset because the G30 announced it before the Fed did. I thought that was really, really bad. It was just bad optics. It's, wait a minute, why is this happening? But do you think that they're relying too much on that standing repo facility to facilitate what they're going to need to do here going forward?
Look, I think they have no choice but to rely on that standing repo facility, because think about what money and money markets are all about. It's all about the marginal demand for cash and the marginal creation of that cash through the lending and deposit creation process, right? So again, if you go back to the basic commodity trade, and if you think about every commodity trader as a levered entity where you borrow money to lease a ship, you borrow money to fill up a ship, you basically ship commodities from port A to port B, just to kind of capture the commodities zeitgeist. I mean, it's all loans and deposits getting created and money is slushing around. But again, back to the euro dollar concept, this is all euro dollars that we are talking about. And these excess surpluses that end up with the exporters, that's what gets recycled at treasury auctions. If that cycle is broken once again, right, then you start to invoice some of this in renminbi, you start to invoice some of this in rubles, or if you still, you know, invoice it in dollars, but you know the commodity price dynamics are basically pointing to a very messy and volatile world for inflation and interest rates, and the allure of treasuries just becomes less attractive because of that, and even people start buying equities or other real assets. What you basically come back to is that whatever money is getting created on the margin isn't going into treasuries, it's going into a different currency or into a different asset class. And so someone else is going to have to create money on the margin to absorb the demand for treasuries that, you know, nobody wants now on the margin. And so whether that's through POMOs or TOMOs, doesn't really matter. I guess optically it's better for the Fed if it's through TOMOs, but if it's through TOMOs, then it's the standing repo facility. So I think the funny thing about these central bank, I guess, facilities and operations, like something changes, and then nothing happens after a while after that change, and then that new facility becomes the dominant thing that we all look for basically finding clearing prices. So I think the standing repo facility is going to be structurally very important. It's obviously not important now because we have $1.5 trillion of cash in the reverse repo facility. So we are at this, you know, excess cash environment, but you know, soon enough, I think a year and a half from now, we can very, very easily imagine a world where, you know, RRP is back down to zero. And then on the margin, the Fed will have to add liquidity into the system with the standing repo facility. So it's like it or not, I think it is going to be a very important part of the system.
So, Richard, if I may, so when we talk about, and you wrote so eloquently about it with the sanctions. So the sanctions, while many people want to celebrate them as being so sterile and clean and it's having the effect, that may be the appearance of the effect, you know, and I just, I watched the interview with Dalip Singh on 60 Minutes. I watched it the next day because people, I usually don't watch any type of news anymore. It's over the years, and I used to be such a news junkie, but I'd rather read you than anything else I'm going to see, especially on cable television. But presentation of it was so nice and clean, and we're having this impact. You know, my first response being that I'm an anti-Vietnam War child. I was very active in it, and I kept thinking that I'm watching Robert McNamara talk, you know, because everything seems so neat and clean. And yep. when she asked him, actually, do you believe these sanctions are an act of war? And I think that's a very important question. She asked that question, and he said, his response was, we need to be very sober in our rhetoric. Mm-hmm. That's a nice statement, but picking up from where you've been with this and the sanctions' long-term effect is to undermine is too strong a word, but to certainly question the not just the reserve status of the dollar, but the entire global system. Now, of course, we can certainly know that there is nothing to supplant it at this time. Europe has so many things to work out, and we don't even know where they're going to go with their balance sheet issues as Lagarde struggles, I think, mightily. I think she's under a lot of pressure. We don't see it as much, but if you watch her press conference and listen to her, I think she's under a severe amount of pressure, especially from what we call the Hanseatic Five, that things are changing. But I look at the Chinese, and they've certainly had some sense of where they want us to go, and they were the first ones to talk about central bank digital coins.
Yep.
And you know, I talked about this with people that I think you would probably respect too, Zuloff on these podcasts, by the way, and Mark Faber, and we've talked about this. And if the Chinese were really trying to disrupt, and they are high quality disruptors in many ways, but if they were looking to disrupt the global monetary system, would they not create a digital or a central bank digital coin that had some semblance of well, I think you even wrote about it with Keynes and the Bancorp, but really some precious metal component. So if I had a digital renminbi, but it had a 5% gold back and maybe a 10% silver back, would that even move more, especially with the impact of the sanctions and the way that they attacked the central bank, meaning the U.S. Security Department apparatus, that they went right after that, and they had figured that it was going to be a big thing, and they were holding that in their quiver. But with the Chinese move to solidify their currency with some hard money backing in today's world fiat currency, would you see a structural change in that?
So look, a couple of things. Yes, I think sanctions are a form of war, without a doubt. I mean, you know, we had what started as a diplomatic conflict that turned into a military conflict, and then the sanctions came. So you know, there's a handful of domains of war, and definitely sanctions are one of them. The one thing about sanctions, which I'd like to highlight before we go to China, is, you know, so first of all, 30 days ago, I mean, no one would have thought that we would be having these types of conversations about, you know, commodity crisis, price level, inflation out of hand, you know, structurally inflation expectations, all this stuff, right? I mean, whole new regime for how we think about dollars as the reserve currency, what the Fed should do in a situation where, you know, you have a supply driven price problem, not a demand driven price problem. So again, I think this is all coming from the Western response to, again, what started as a diplomatic foreign policy type crisis. Now, the odd thing about all this is that, and again, you know, I'm not a foreign policy expert, and you know Ian Bremmer knows these things a lot better than I do, but just to be clear, I think nobody in the West, I think, who designed these sanctions assumed that we will be talking about these things 30 days from now, right? I mean, this is basically a completely new regime for financial stability and price stability. And I think nobody thought about this in sanctions design land, simply because the sanctions by design exclude the commodity trade. You know, commodity flows, physical and related financial flows, are still supposed to be happening. Entities like Gazprom Bank are not sanctioned. Their assets were not frozen. They are not de-swifted. So you basically cocooned the commodity complex from the whole sanctions design process. But what ended up happening, you know, I guess unintended consequences of all this, is that the private sector is sanctioning itself because it just doesn't want to touch any commodities coming out of Russia. It doesn't want to finance anyone, you know, moving commodities come out of Russia. And you know, if you're a ship owner, you don't want to lease your ships to anyone who wants to move stuff out of Russia. So basically, it's this self-sanctioning aspect of the private sector that is driving, I think, this ferocious, you know, financial and macro kind of shock that came out of these sanctions. Because again, you know, the freezing of the central bank's assets is a big deal, and we are talking about the medium term consequences of that. De-swifting the Russian banking system was not a big deal. You know, everybody thought that to be the big thing, but including me, but it actually turned out to be a sleeper. But again, the impact on the price level, commodity prices, and because of that, you know, Fed policy down the line and long-term interest rates, inflation expectations, I think these are kind of accidental aspects of all this, because the pain on the West from this is I think quite sizable, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. So I think the sanctions is very interesting again, because by intention the design was X, and not by intention the kind of collateral spillover impact of this is something quite dramatic and quite sizable that I think took many people by surprise. So that's one. China. Again, I think there's two things here. If you're China and you have a lot of FX reserves, simply because they're just the poster child of FX reserve accumulation, what do you do other than treasuries? Again, I think the answer there is physical commodities. And again, it's not Bretton Woods 1 and Bretton Woods 3, because, you know, gold is nice to have as a monetary anchor. But basically, there is a smell of kind of resource inequality in all this. When you think about the next, you know, decade, it's, you know, if globalization is over, instead of just-in-time supply chains and just-in-time provision of commodities, you know, James Aitken actually calls this the, you know, the just-in-case accumulation of commodities, whether it's fossil fuels or metals or grain, or a just-in-case
duplication of supply chains. I mean, again, the next 5 to 10 decades, the next 5 to 10 years are going to be extremely commodity intensive. I think commodities inequality and resource inequality is probably going to replace income inequality as the biggest kind of topic that governments are going to have to attack and worry about. And in a world like that, it makes no sense to accumulate paper wealth that, number one, is going, the value of which is going to be eroded by inflation. The currency in which it's denominated is probably going to weaken for things we talked about. And three, where you have a confiscation risk if you come into, you know, conflict with another great power in the South China Sea. Okay. So I think diversifying away from all this is imperative. Gold is definitely going to be a part of the answer. You know, commodity stockpiles are also going to be a part of the answer. And also, you know, this is just China's FX reserves, but, you know, you have other commodity exporters like the Saudis and Iran and Russia. You know, this is also going to mean that for other exporters, they are going to diversify away from the dollar and then accumulate surpluses in China. Now, when I say this to clients, you know, everybody's like, well, you know, China is not an open capital account. They don't have the bonds to, you know, if you start accumulating surpluses, like what kind of asset are you going to buy? And so that's never going to happen, basically, is the standard response, which is nonsense. And it's nonsense because it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. And, you know, you're a father to a daughter, Ira, and I'm a father to a daughter. And we all know that, you know, children are born babies and then they grow up to be, you know, grown up individuals. Currencies are not born reserve currencies. They grow up to be reserve currencies. So, you know, just think about what happened with China and the dollar. They started to export when they became a part of the World Trade Organization. They started to accumulate surpluses in banks. And then they started to buy bills. And then 5-year treasuries, 10-year treasuries, then they started to buy mortgages. Then they funded CIC and they started to do private equity stuff. And then a central bank had so many reserves that it basically said, we're not going to accumulate any of this stuff. You know, you banking system, please recycle all these dollar surpluses through your books and fund One Belt, One Road and lend in the FX swap market or what have you. It's a gradual process. So, you know, if Russia and the Saudis are going to start invoicing oil trades between China and their respective selves in RMB, they are going to start accumulating RMB balances in the Chinese banking system. And when there is so many balances that the Chinese banks say, we don't want to run with all these idle balances anymore, then the government is going to issue debt to soak up all that cash in the banking system and take it onto the government's balance sheet. But, you know, this is how bits and pieces of becoming a reserve currency come together. And then the most important thing about this is everybody says that, well, China has an ex ante closed capital account, and so I'm not going to go in there, which is fine. The U.S. has an ex ante open capital account, but an ex post closed capital account if things don't go well. You know, it's the case with the Central Bank of Russia. So ex ante open, ex post closed, or ex ante closed and ex post at some point 5-10 years from now open, doesn't really matter. So I think we need to think in very realistic terms. And again, you know, China has been laying the groundwork and the plumbing for the internationalization of the renminbi, but it's always wars, and it's always big world events that happen that become the catalyst for one currency to grow in importance and for another currency to decline in importance. I mean, that was the story with sterling and the dollar. That was the story with, you know, dollar on gold and then dollar to euro dollar. And now this is what's going to be the story with euro dollars and euro renminbi. These things are all happening.
You know, this is such a great discussion because on these podcasts with the Financial Repression Authority, we have been discussing this. I mean, it began with Louis Gavet probably 18 months ago, but we discussed this because your point that everybody, when COVID started and the global economy started turning down, every analyst talked about, well, the Chinese would probably move to devalue the renminbi in some capacity. And yet that wasn't happening. We went from 6.9 to 6.8 to 6.7. And it actually, I would talk about it quite a bit, and others did too, saying something's going on here. And what it has to be, because food prices weren't going down when everything else was going down, everybody was talking about supply bottlenecks, but the Chinese had to be stockpiling everything from copper to iron ore, and certainly food. And it's interesting, and it was done with the renminbi or the yuan staying strong. And that was always, of course, Pettis's article. If you're going to move to a more middle-class economy, you want to enrich your economy by keeping a strong currency, which they've been. I mean, right now we're sitting and looking at the yuan at 6.37. And last Thursday, the Wall Street Journal came out, because they did an article on global wheat stockpiles. Yep. Lo and behold, the Chinese have 50% of global wheat stockpiles, an 18-month supply. The U.S. has 6%. So you see that they do have a game there. Now, interestingly enough, because we're in the middle of now, everybody's got a comment about the weak yen, right? And you can see it shifting. It stopped from being a haven, and energy prices soared. All of a sudden, China was deemed by a lot of speculators to be, that's their weak link, and they drove the yen. And the Bank of Japan did nothing to stop it. Yep. But here's a very interesting point as we sit here. In 1994, I don't even know if you were where you were at. You may have been, I'm not sure how old you are.
But, I think I was in high school in 1994.
Okay. So the yen yuan was at 1922, meaning there was 19 yen to each yuan. On January 1st, with the advent of NAFTA, China depreciates the yuan from 5.8 to 8.7. And of course, the yuan yen drops down from 1922 immediately down to like 12. So that was a significant move. Right now, we are right back at that level ending 1993 of the yen yuan.
Yep.
This is a critical factor, because if the Chinese are content with letting the yuan strengthen even more, because they import so much highly engineered and improved technology from Japan, but there are areas that they do compete with Japan now. So the fact that this currency is back to where it was, how many years ago? Oh, that's 29 years ago. Oh my God.
Yep.
So here we are. So your point is beautifully well taken, because the Chinese are doing something. It's like you make the point, and I think it needs to be made, is that, you know, people with dollars in zero interest rate environments, you know, they go out and buy Maseratis, Ferraris, Picassos. The Chinese actually have bought stuff to stockpile that they use. When will that change? I don't know, but they have certainly indulged in it and have aided a lot of economies. But the question I think that will come is when they do make that shift, it's an interesting point you make, that we go bit step by step by step. There's no big dynamic. There's no depreciation anymore of the yuan from 5.8 to 8.7. That's not happening. And there's no appreciation like that. Everything will be done in drips and drabs. So and it signals a lot to the world. And your beautiful point from the Bretton Three piece was at the end of the petrodollar, it was allowing the Chinese to use their muscle to buy discounted oil. So they were basically arbitraging the dollar yuan market, which was, you made that point. And if you can expound on that a little bit more, I think it would help people, because it's such a great point.
Yeah, I think you're referring to how the how China and PBOC is the only player that can basically arb the Russian non-Russia commodities basis, right?
Right.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the idea is basically simple, right? So, you know, every crisis is a crisis of collateral or funding. You know, you either have, I mean, you have the four prices of money, as I've learned it from Perry Merling. You know, the four prices of money are par, interest, foreign exchange, and the price level, the price of the price of commodities. And, you know, par is what broke in 2008 when you had bank runs and money fund shares, one for one, you know, different forms of money that didn't work. You know, interest is always either about, you know, how many hikes up or down, or bases between various interest rates. Foreign exchange is, you know, 1997, we broke FX banks in Southeast Asia because FX reserves were missing. And now we have, you know, commodities at the heart of everything that we are talking about. And there is this Russia, non-Russia basis, because it's like weird, because this is a demand-driven supply shock, right? It's not a supply shock. It's a demand-driven supply shock. Sanctions-driven, right? Because nobody wants to be the next Mark Rich, and Mark Rich and Co., right? Because, you know, he was moving the wrong kind of oil,
right?
And that's the birth of Glencore. You know, the downfall of Mark Rich and Co. is you know, all the commodity traders, you know, started anew. So it's burned in your DNA what you can do and what you cannot do. Okay, and the other interesting thing about this commodities basis that opened up is that if you think about crises, you know, 1997, 2008, 2020, the job of a central bank in a crisis is you provide emergency liquidity to who needs it, and you buy the problem asset. Okay, so you always do QE, asset purchases, and you always do emergency lending through some fancy facility, okay? And typically, when things are in the domain of the nominal, okay, money fund shares, you know, the par value of bank deposits, FX rates, cross-currency bases, all these things, bond basis, right? One central bank, Fed, the ECB, whoever, can buy the troubled asset, it's a financial asset, and can lend to the regulated institutions, the dealers and the banks. The price level and the whole commodities complex is where real and nominal come together. It's a nominal price for commodities, but commodities are real world things. So number one, central banks are not very well placed to deal with any of this. And if you think about the current crisis as a crisis of commodities, it's a crisis of Russian commodities, which nobody wants to touch and move. So Western Central Bank is not going to be able to do anything about the inflationary impact of this demand-driven supply shock, because they are the bank operating subsidiary of the sovereigns that are driving the sanctions. Okay, you can only use tools like, you know, lending facilities if you need to lend to commodity traders, or, you know, interest rate hikes or what have you, to kind of deal with the implications of all this. But you cannot go and attack the root cause of the problem, which is that someone needs to soak up all these commodities that are offline and circulate it back into the world economy. That is a state, that actor who can do that and that clean that up is a state that dances to her own tunes. And it ain't the West. It's China. And so whether it's the PBOC buying this directly, or the PBOC issue, you know, buying the debt of a newly established, you know, state-owned corporation whose job is going to build, you know, to buy ships and to build storage facilities for energy and metals and wheat or other foodstuffs. It doesn't matter if it's you know, the PBOC doing it directly or indirectly by financing a new state-owned company, but basically that's where all the cleanup is going to occur. That's the only place where this can occur. And now when you kind of, you know, bring all this into the fold with the FX value of the renminbi, if you let the renminbi appreciate, you basically have a kind of commodity central bank of the world that is on friendly terms with the largest commodity producer, has a large stockpile of commodities, and at the same time lets its currency appreciate for its own domestic kind of reasons. This is bad for the West, and double bad when you think about some of the things that the West is trying to do with, you know, net zero emissions. You just have to look at Mark Carney's NAEP speech from last week. That's going to require a lot of investment. When you think about, you know, Europe's desire to wean itself off of Russian fossil fuels, but if you want to build steel mills, if you want to build windmills, you need concrete and steel for that, right? If you want to build more atomic power plants, you need uranium for that. If you want to rearm, you need metals for that. And where are all those commodities going to come from? So I think, you know, you've been in this trade for a long time, Ira, but you know, it's always been a kind of nominal game where the euro dollar is getting created day in, day out, every single time. We have some crisis that's like in the nominal domain, some foreign exchange or some money fund breaks the buck, or, you know, there's a giant overdraft and, you know, banks have to fund corporations instead of funding RV traders and the bond basis blows up. And like, you can easily deal with these things. Okay. Central banks are not well positioned to deal with any of these issues. These are, you know, the domain of states to kind of sort and figure out. But this is going to be a very complex 5 to 10 years. And I think it's time to start thinking differently because, you know, as I said earlier on, this is day 30 into a completely new regime. And, you know, old ways of dealing with inflationary impulses, old ways of running your portfolio, old ways of constructing your portfolios, you have to all rethink it and go back to basics. It's like what Soros said, that, you know, when the game changes and the rules change, you gotta adapt. It's time to adapt.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's really a great point. And we're gonna wind up back at some point. You know, I was in university in the 70s and studying with some of the best Marxist minds about the petrodollars and the recycling of the petrodollars and the coming collapse in the Western banking system. And so when I went actually out to get a job, they kind of laughed at me because everybody said, this is the best lending we're doing, right? But it takes a little while to work through some of this to understand it. And that was the birth of the petrodollar when the Saudis promised the U.S. that they would supply oil, and the U.S. promised the Saudis that the dollar, they would do their best to keep the dollar a responsible reserve currency after being delinked from as Jacques Roof would say, the gold exchange standard. And, you know, so then you get all that. So are we going to undermine that? We shall see. But I can't let you go because I have to discuss this with you. Your views is where we are. Sorry, Richard, I'm preempting you here a little bit.
But go ahead.
The yield curve is so interesting today. And you are, I know two or three or four very good plumbers of the interest rate markets. James Aiken and is certainly the best I know. And I read you because I have great respect for you. So can we look at the curve here and the way you see it? Because I have some views on it, but I'm much more interested to hear you. I think people would be too.
Look, I mean, I don't think the curve is right. I don't think the curve is right. I mean, the curve is what it is either because, you know, central banks sit on a bunch of duration and there's not enough and there's some structural reason why the back end is so anchored and cannot really steepen. I mean, you know, this has been haunting us ever since Greenspan. Right. I mean, he called it the conundrum, and then Ben Bernanke called it the savings glut. And yeah, so it's there. You know, you can't raise interest rates because, you know, you hike twice and then it inverts. So that's number one. Number two, there is the, well, you know, we're going to over hike and there's going to be too much inflation and there's going to be a recession and blah, blah, blah. Rates are going down. OK. Number one, we just devoted the first, you know, 90% of our conversation to the idea that the savings glut is over, right? I mean, nobody has an incentive to add to G7 G7 inside money portfolios anymore. You will probably diversify away from them. And you know, it's much better to stockpile on commodities than paper money, number one. Or again, beautifully implicit in what you just said, just let your currency appreciate. I mean, that's another way out from all these reserves. And why the hell am I, you know, suppressing the value of my currency when there's all these issues that we are talking about? Let's just let it rip, you know, let that deliver some inflationary impulse to the West. Meanwhile, you know, I stock up on cheap commodities and I let my currency appreciate and, you know, increase real value for the real wealth of my consumers. So that's about to change. You know, demand for treasuries is going to change. If demand for treasuries changes, I mean, that's going to have an impact on the yield curve. But again, this is inevitable. It's not imminent. Okay. So that's number one. Number two, you know, the Fed is going to do QT, but we all understand it to be passive QT, where they are going to let the securities, you know, mature, and, you know, the private sector is going to have to absorb more at auctions, blah, blah, blah. However, you know, that's passive QT done by the Fed, but then that can also be paired with active QT from foreign central banks. The Fed doesn't buy because they're shrinking their portfolio. I'm not buying either because I don't want to add anything to it. Hell, I'm even selling on the margin because I want to stockpile on commodities and I want to let my currency appreciate. So QT, I think is going to get very complicated, because we should not think about QT just in the context of the Fed, but also what these other central banks are going to do. I mean, duration is duration, and it's warehoused in many different places for many different reasons. But basically, those warehouses are about to puke a lot of duration. Okay, so I think there is going to be an impact from that on the yield curve, for sure. Number one. Number two, I mean, we are talking about these things, but the market is not really talking about this, because, you know, depending on who you talk to, you know, certainly a part of the client base is definitely of the mind, well, you know, how long do you think Putin is going to be there? And, you know, is this going to be over or not over? It's going to be peace talks, and maybe all the commodities are going to come back, and growth is going to slow, and then commodity prices are going to fall. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, that's a view. But, you know, if you again go back to the earlier parts of this conversation, there's a very real chance that this is about something more structural and long lasting that's going to have a big impact on inflation expectations. And the Fed can't really do anything about it, because this is not 08 and it's not 2020, where you can raise and lower interest rates to police demand. This is about supply problems. And central banks cannot do anything about supply problems. If anything, you know, governments are going to have to do something about this, you know, stockpiling and whatnot. But again, that is a fiscal spend, you know, whether you rearm or increase military spending or increase stuff, that's going to need financing. And if that needs financing, that's additional supply. And then the fourth thing I would say, again, you've been in the game long enough to remember that, you know, central banks, there's this, you know, opportunistic disinflation. High rates generate a recession, create some slack such that, you know, inflation tames, and then that was kind of the game. You know, that's what Greenspan did, right? Opportunistic disinflation. Ever since Greenspan, we haven't had anything like that. I mean, we had a big recession in 08, and then we were growing. No recession, no nothing. Inflation was not a problem. And so here we are again. So what can a central bank do to tame these things? Nothing really. And also think about where is the spending and the borrowing needs going to come from to deal with the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to be coming from the governments, right? Stockpiling, rearming, net zero emissions. It's going to come from corporations to duplicate supply chains, right? Because it's prudent to do so. So there is going to be an increase in credit demand, but none of this credit demand is going to be sensitive to interest rates, because it just has to be done. And it's a very big difference when you have a private, when you have an economy where the private sector is the main borrower, you know, interest rates up and down, and that's going to curb the credit demand of corporations and households, versus when you have the government as the largest driver of credit demand, because the government doesn't really care. And the government actually has a bank, it's called the central bank, in its pocket. And, you know, sometimes the very high level kind of state goals are, you know, high asset prices and stable inflation, consumer economy, and sometimes it's survival, rearm and, you know, restock and all these things. And so the big question for me is basically, yes, the central bank is going to raise interest rates. Yes, the central bank is going to do QT because that's the natural impulse to do when inflation, you know, is not a problem to inflation becomes a big problem. The question, of course, is going to be, are you going to raise rates enough to bring real interest rates positive? And I think the answer there is no. And if the answer is no, then the bond market is going to revolt. And if the bond market is going to revolt, it won't be able to revolt too much because the Fed occasionally is going to have to employ QE just to kind of calm down where the back end of the curve is. But just to be clear, I think the curve is absolutely wrong. I think the idea that rate hikes and all these commodity price shocks are going to cause a recession is incorrect. I think every government in the West is going to pull everything it has out to basically shield the impact of these commodity price moves on the consumer, which means that they're going to have to issue a lot to basically buy at world prices and sell at home at subsidized prices. And I think the implications of all this on the yield curve is pretty obvious, and it's one way. It's just that the market hasn't really discounted the enormity and the complexity of all these issues yet.
So yes, I'm glad we're having this discussion because when I used to be on with Santelli all the time, we would talk yield curves and CNBC would always cut it short because, you know, you know it as well as anybody, you know, they don't want to, it was making people's eyes glaze over. And I always look at the 530 versus the two, to me, the 210 is a much more institutional, where the 530 is always a speculative curve, as I like, and I'm a speculator, so I certainly understand it. And I'm watching this here, and I've been looking for flatteners pretty dramatically. One of the reasons was because I know that the Fed, with its huge balance sheet, but it doesn't hedge its portfolio. So we were missing a huge player out of a potential seller as interest rates went up. They don't have to. They don't have to, because as Jerome Powell told me, they have a printing press. So ultimately that's the bottom line. But when I look at this 530 that we inverted yesterday, I think to -7, and I look at it and I go, why would anybody, with everything you just said, why would anybody be taking on 25 more years of duration? I'm talking theoretically, of course.
Yeah.
And earn less in today's environment, which is so fraught with speed bumps of all kinds that nobody's ever seen this before. Because we've never seen.
You know, you've never seen it before. And so you have to make a decision, and it's the fork in the road, and you either go left or you go right. And, you know, there is some monster at one and there is redemption at the other. And I don't know, maybe it's some pension fund that says, you know, stocks are high, so maybe I'm just going to lock in, you know, rates at this level and match my assets and liabilities and whatnot and call it a day. And others are going to say, you know, I just stay in equities because when inflation is high and bond yields are going to be policed to be low and the Fed is going to hike, but not enough. And real, you know, financial repression is about to get worse and speed up. You know, maybe equities are not a bad place to be. And, you know, some people think like that. Some people are buying bonds and, you know, it's a smaller supply in the bond market. So maybe that's the impact that you see there. But I do agree with you that it's weird.
Yeah, it seems that we're getting to the end of it. And on your wonderful piece you wrote before the beginning of the Ukraine war, where Powell should seek his inner Volcker, and I'm not a Powell fan. I keep wondering why, outside of political expediency, he'd be reappointed for not just the politics of the progressives, but, you know, I know that Biden doesn't want to fight there. So And as somebody told me who's very knowledgeable about Inside Washington, is that they've been very happy because Powell's been so pro employment that they can, that even the progressives can live very comfortably with him, because he stakes out that, you know, again, as he would love to say, and I call him the Minister of Social Justice, you know, through no fault of their own, it seemed to be his mantra throughout all of this until inflation proved non-transitory. So in your sense, in calling upon his inner Volcker, where, and this is a word they love to use now, but they don't define it. Larry Summers has been trying to define it.
Yeah.
What is neutral?
Well, neutral. I think it's very high. It's not state dependent, you know. Neutral was what it was 5 years ago and 10 years ago, and with I mean, neutral is very high in Europe, probably, right?
Right.
Because you need to rewire the grid from an energy perspective. You need to rearm. And you need to restock on a bunch of stuff. You know, the U.S. needs to do a lot of the same, but again, you need to build the extra chip factory. I mean, you know, in the world in which we are talking about, you know, just think about your favorite, you know, mostly brand value added, you know, gizmo you hold in your hand, that's got only a brand but no real facilities. Maybe you just need to duplicate a lot of those production lines in the U.S. Whether it's chips or the assembly of other popular items or God knows what. I think, again, you know, the state needs, states will rearm because trust is gone. You know, as James Aitken would say, just in time becomes just in case. You duplicate supply chains. You beef up stockpiles of everything. You rearm, and all of a sudden there is credit demand that's different. There's a lot of credit demand from the state, so that's higher base rates, right, and higher R-star and higher, you know, yield curve shifting higher. It's credit demand from you know, different corporations, and you know, credit demand that's not there to buy back stock and not to pay a fat dividend and not to take some company private, but like stuff to build stuff. And then there is, you know, net zero emissions and solar panels and wind turbines and whatever net zero means. And that requires investment, and interest rates have to go higher on the back of that. So I don't know where neutral is, but it's definitely higher than what the market is thinking. And, you know, it's, as they say, that 1 year, 5 year forward, that's at risk of kind of getting shocked higher. Once that happens, I think we're in a completely different regime for interest rates.
Not sure how much more time we have, Zoltan, but we have a question from one of our listeners. Great, yeah. Just a question on one of our listeners in terms of your view of a new world order that is centered around commodity-based currencies in the East. What specific commodities do you like the best, or you think make the most sense from an investor like in the Western world?
What investment would make the most sense?
Yes, and centered around specific commodities that might be interesting from this new world order.
Right. Well, first of all, I didn't know we were live, so I'm quite embarrassed for the background noise earlier. Because as I said, my wife wanted a new window in the living room over the terrace, so they are drilling and putting it in. So sorry for all the listeners. So what do you do? Well, look, I think you buy gold. I think that's a very obvious winner. I think you know, short euro and long RMB. I think commodity traders, actually not the commodity traders, I think companies that own ships are probably another, you know, structural beneficiary to all this, because again, once you have, everything is shipped in commodity space, right? Whether it's dry cargo or wet cargo, again, you need ships for that. And shipping routes are getting redrawn. You know, instead of shipping stuff from northern Russia to Rotterdam, you don't have to bring to China and from China to Rotterdam. So, you know, everything's going to take more time. You need bigger vessels for that. So again, I think shipping freight rates are also a good way of expressing some of these themes. And I think equities are naturally going to benefit from all this. Some equities, obviously not all. But again, you know, rates and credits are I think going into a completely different regime from here. So it's some of those things that you want to think about.
Good. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm not going to add to that. I mean, I think Zoltan's pointing the question on, because as we, you know, we had the three quote unquote giants talk last week about how the Ukraine war was leading to deglobalization. We heard from Adam Posen. We heard from Larry Fink of BlackRock, of course. And the best one I thought was Howard Marks, of course, from Oaktree, who wrote a really good piece. So in that reference point, I think that's where Zoltan goes, that deglobalization, I think from everything Zoltan said, would agree with it, is will lead to higher costs. Because first of all, you've had capital has been rewarded around the globe, certainly for the last 35 years. And it's, of course, the basis of Thomas Piketty with R is greater than G, because global capital has been able to arbitrage the onslaught of probably 1.5 billion new workers into the market economy. It won't be able to do that anymore. And therefore, the cost of capital, I think, is going to rise dramatically, and the cost of labor is going to rise where capital needs it. So I think we're going to go into a very, very interesting point. Now, not all things are going to be equal. The emerging markets are going to become very interesting here, because especially if U.S. interest rates go up, if the dollar goes down, I think it'll make their lives easier because they're so borrowed in dollars. It's one of the, to me, massive negative fallouts that the Fed doesn't want to claim responsibility for, but the massive borrowing, and not just sovereign borrowing in the emerging markets, but corporate borrowing in dollars, is really an outcome. And as Milton Friedman would wonderfully say, there's no free lunch. So we spend time, and I know that's part of my task as a global macro person, is to look to see where there is no free lunch and how it will manifest itself into a tradable opportunity. So that's where I would see that. I'm not going to go specifically though.
Yeah, it's probably there was a free lunch for a long time, but if you are living on free lunches all the time, you get massive indigestion at some point. Right? That's what we are looking at now.
Well said.
Well, awesome. Yeah, thank you so much, Zoltan and Ira. And how can our listeners learn more about your work? Zoltan, do you have like a blog or a regular type of...
I have a regular publication at Credit Suisse. And so if your listener is a Credit Suisse client and not on a distribution yet, then, you know, they should contact their Credit Suisse sales representative and they will get added to the distribution list.
I'll tell you, for all your listeners, I pick up Zoltan. He gets picked up by Forex Factory a lot. And that's where I find the articles may be a little bit older, but it gives me time to read them and not be rushed to read them. So they do pick up credits. Credit Suisse must have a some type of arrangement with them, because that's where I can find your articles. And then, of course, after the last few articles you've written, everybody's been picking it up, from the Financial Times to the Wall Street Journal to even people on television who I don't think really ever bothered to pay one ounce of attention to you, started paying attention. So,
yes, it's, I mean, I think it's been an interesting time because, you know, the past 5 years were 2015. It's kind of like the golden age of kind of micro plumbing, because there were lots of spread moves all related to Basel III and reserves and balance sheet. And it was kind of micro macro. This is macro macro. And, you know, I mean, I've done a number of things in life, and, you know, just digging into the shadow banking system. And then after, you know, my stint in the public sector, I did work with Paul McCulley about, you know, the long history of fiscal monetary cooperation and whatnot. So, you know, when you're in the seat, as you know, your role always evolves with the environment. You need to adapt. So I think it's now back to macro, because, you know, when you think about those four prices of money, par and interest rate and bases for FX rates and the price level of things, this is about FX rates and price level first and foremost, the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, basis markets are going to be, I think, fairly boring, apart from this idea that we mentioned about the cross currency basis potentially going positive in this environment. You know, it's a different environment. It's a different game. So you have to write about different things. So probably that's why it's a more broad audience that latched onto to some of these things. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, this awesome. Thank you so much. Agreeing to do this. I think it's very enlightening. Hopefully we can do another one. And the things that you write and where you're going, I think, is very important for anybody who trades in this arena, especially global macro, to find their way and sift their way through it. I've been around a long time, and you're one of my first go-to reads, because especially in understanding the plumbing and looking at the plumbing, because I started out primarily as a foreign exchange trader, believe it or not. So back in the 70s, after the fall of Bretton Woods, that's what I had learned when I was in school about funding of multinational corporations, as they call them then. So I pay very close attention to the things that you've written about even before you delve back into the global macro. So thank you.
Very nice. It's very kind of you to say that. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sultan and Ira. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Richard, for hosting it.
Yeah. Yep.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.